when people think about Appalachia, I guess, and certainly in the last 8 or 10 years, the thing they think about the most is Hillbilly Elegy. I just wonder what you think that book got wrong.
I'll say this. I think that book had more to do with what liberals outside of the region wanted Appalachia to be than anything else.
Hey, y'all. I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Robert Geit grew up in Tennessee, but he spent most of his adult life teaching art and making art in the coal country of eastern Kentucky. He's best known for his theater productions that bring in community members as actors and playwrights to produce shows about hot-button issues such as strip mining and opioids. He's a consultant to the upcoming Hulu series called Dope Sick, based on the best-selling book about the opioid crisis in Appalachia. Along the way, Geip has written and illustrated 3 novels dealing with some of the same issues. The last book in the trilogy, called Pop, came out just last week. His characters have rough edges, tough problems, and big hearts. They've also been failed by a country that doesn't know or care much about what happens back in the holler. Robert Geip cares. Here's our conversation. I read somewhere that this book, Pop, that just came out, is part of, well, I know it's part of a trilogy, but I read somewhere that you had it in your head as sort of a trilogy all along. Is that right?
Kind of. I was one of my major formative experiences as a writer was taking an extended novel workshop with Darnell Arnault, who's a writer, now lives in North Carolina for a long time. She taught at Lincoln Memorial University in Tennessee. But anyway, she did this thing for mostly for writers who were working at other things and couldn't just, you know, stop and go write all the time, but had to squeeze it into a working life. And she had this workshop where you would go every 3 months for a weekend, and you do this intensive weekend of writing prompts and reading your work in front of a group. And then she'd give you a bunch of assignments. You know, maybe we're having a little trouble visualizing themselves actually doing that. So you did a lot of kind of visualization exercises, and one of them was name every book you're going to write, like see your whole, you know, visualize yourself as a writer. And so I came up with the names, and at that time I was still kind of trying to get a first draft of the first book, Trampoline. And so I just said, all right, they're going to be called Trampoline, Weed Eater, and Pop. And I don't know if how other people do it, but I basically wrote backwards from the titles.
I've heard about people writing songs like that all the time. In fact, I know, you know, songwriters have like these kind of hook books, notebooks they carry around with a bunch of titles in them. But I don't know that I've heard of like a full-length book being written that way. Now, when you were thinking of these titles, did you also think about doing them with illustrations like these books are done?
Well, that story is also Darnell related. I assumed that when I got into this novel workshop, you know, that I would pound out that first draft and Darnell would be so taken with it that she would immediately introduce me to her agent and all her distinguished writer friends and, you know, next stop Johnny Carson or whatever, whoever's doing Jay Leno. I don't even know who hosts the Tonight Show anymore. Stephen Colbert, you know, that I'd be on the glide path. And that didn't happen. And so then I about abandoned the project. I had all this stuff and it was pretty incoherent. And so I decided not to abandon it, but at that, the other kind of anchor of my writing development was going to the Appalachian Writers Workshop at Hyman, Kentucky, at Hyman Settlement School. And so what I decided to do, I'm like, well, to hell with this. A part of the titles of the book came from I kind of, and this is funny that you say that about songs, because I, I wanted it to be kind of punk rock, and I had been involved in zine culture and college radio and DIY this and that. And so I was like, well, you know what? It's like, I'm just going to do things that do this in a way that I enjoy. And so I started making little handmade 16-page books with their own little covers. And they were always a part of the novel, but I was basically serializing it. And that's when I started putting the pictures in the way they appear now. And so I took them to Hyman, and, and a big part of that, one of the things I love about that workshop, there's a lot of just really kind of reading for the participants, not just the teachers and guest writers, but every afternoon there's a pretty structured reading by other aspirants. And so I started reading out of these little books, and then I'd sell them for $3 a piece or $4 with an autograph in them. So that
that's
anyway,
great.
So then Marianne Worthington, who does a great Appalachian literature website, arts and literature website, they do stuff other than just writing, called Still the Journal. And she asked if they could start serializing the book on it. And so, and the drawings were incorporated in that. And then the publisher at the time, Jill Berkowitz of Ohio University Press, saw the work on there and asked if I'd be interested in publishing it.
Now, you do something with those illustrations that I have not seen anywhere else, which is that you're reading the book, you're reading the text, and all of a sudden you see the illustration. But instead of the illustration just like being like a side piece, I guess, to the text, you have the character actually speaking a lot of dialogue that's part of the flow of the narrative. I had not seen that before your books. Did that come from somewhere else, or that just from in your head, or where?
I think it's one way to put it. It would be a laziness, too lazy to create an actual graphic novel. So you didn't really, I didn't really, or have the chops, have the artistic chops to do it. So it was kind of a hybrid that way. And then since I've been in Harlan, I had been involved with creating theater to be performed by the community out of the community's oral histories. So I was very interested in oral history and really just the way people reveal and conceal themselves in interviews. Part of the whole thing was that this was a reluctant narrator, that somebody was probably interviewing her. And so I really wanted to reinforce that this was a person talking, not writing.
There's so many lines in this book that I'm going to be quoting to other people, but there's one in particular I want to talk to you about. You have one of your characters is talking about, this is 2016 election, which is Trump versus Hillary. And you have one of your characters say, "Them two was fighting over a pie we'd forgot the taste of."
Yeah. I live in Eastern Kentucky right now. Grew up in Eastern Tennessee, which had a very different kind of relationship. Where I grew up had a very different relationship to American capitalism. But in Eastern Kentucky, its history is dominated by, since the European incursions of the coal industry. And most of the communities that the students that came to the community college where I teach, most of them were from coal mining communities. And the coal mining industry in this country, at least is the way it manifested in Appalachia, was not very interested in a great diversity of economy in the communities where it existed. So, through the 70s into the 80s, this area was like the cornerstone of the Democratic Party's voter base. You know, this was a lot of union, a lot of Democratic politicians. I mean, and so part of how that shifted had to do with being somewhat Southern. How this area went from hardcore Democrat to pictures of John F. Kennedy and in many, many houses right up there with Jesus and FDR, even John L. Lewis, to hardcore Trump community is something that, you know, liberals in the region think about a lot. But one of the things that interests me is how the Democratic Party lost this place. And I think it has to do with the fact that the war on poverty was still propping up capitalism, you know, that it was giving people just enough to survive without addressing the fundamental inequalities of the way the system distributed labor and distributed wages. And you know, and so to start a bunch of federal poverty programs, I mean, they, you know, it's like there were people starving to death and there were people dying from lack of health care. So it's not that relief wasn't needed. It was that I think there is a lot of bitterness here about how both parties let the system take work away from this place. And so, you know, to me, that's the pie. That's the American pie. The idea that you'd have an economy where everybody could have a decent job. People didn't want handouts. They wanted to go to work in the morning. And so that's kind of a long underpin. That's kind of more of the iceberg of that. You know, it's like they're fighting over something, throwing out pretty speeches and jive ass programs. And, you know, we've forgotten the taste of the pie.
When you started doing these theater projects up in Harlan, up in that part of Kentucky, and you know, made it clear that you wanted these community theater projects to be about things like that, to be about the coal companies and to be about opioids and to be about that sort of thing. Did people understand at first that you even could make art about those subjects?
I think that the short answer is yes. I mean, the way we got going was my community college students asked me if where grants came from. What's a grant? Where does it come from? Because we'd been talking about how money came into the region. And so I said, well, here's a grant proposal. Let's look at this. Because it was one I thought we should apply for. It was about using the arts to address a community crisis. And so this was in 2002. So we chose the opioid crisis. And then we did a big community engagement process on, you know, and we didn't say the arts, but it was interesting. We just talked to several hundred people about how art and creativity was a part of their life. And of course, people play music, people take pictures. I think that it didn't take much thinking to get people thinking about how the way people talk, how the people tell stories, how the people use stories to make moral points, and, you know, just to entertain one another was pretty artful. And then we started talking about how to do that together. I mean, I think one of the things that was a new thing was, you know, that we're going to look at how some of our collective activities that could be considered artistic or cultural could actually help us process the opioid crisis as it was playing out in our community. But of course, you know, so we settled on theater because people remember. I love this. I would have loved to have seen this. A lot of people, older people, talked about how in these 1 and 2 room schoolhouses that kind of dominated the kindergarten through eighth grade environment in the mountains, every Friday they would have a talent show. Basically, every Friday, every kid would have to perform, would have to sing or play the harmonica or, you know, tie knots or whatever it was they knew how to do. And people remember this so fondly because it was like, that, you know, one, it was such a broad definition of what is performance. And two, it's like everybody's got a gift. Everybody's got, you know, some entertaining aspect of their life. And, you know, you were just challenged every week to come up with an act. And it's, you know, and so that was kind of how we started thinking about theater.
I know you are consulting on this TV series that's being made about Beth Macy's incredible book, Dope Sick. What's your confidence level that they understand what you understand?
I'm optimistic about the show. I mean, for those that might not know, Beth Macy lives in Roanoke, Virginia. She wrote a book called Dope Sick about the opioid crisis and particularly about Purdue Pharma and their creation of OxyContin and then their marketing and distribution system for OxyContin. And, you know, and it looks like the show's going to look at the Sackler family that owned Purdue Pharma, and it looks at the coal miners and their families who got addicted to it in this area. And it also looks at the doctors who were prescribing it, the federal attorneys that kind of brought a suit against Purdue Pharma here in the coal fields. You know, kind of looks at the whole dynamic of the crisis and the response to it. And I mean, I think that gives them a leg up. I mean, they're not looking at this as if the challenges that Appalachia faces are solely the result of Appalachian people. You know, that Appalachia is super well integrated into the rest of the United States, perhaps too well integrated into the rest of the United States, if you look at the track record. And so that's really the main source of my optimism. I'm not sure that, you know, they're going to get everything. They're not going to get everything right about life in the community if for no other reason is they hired me to be the custodian of that. And that was, you know, their first blunder. But I know they're trying. I've learned a lot about what it takes. It's interesting. There is so much money in television. At the same time, there wasn't enough money to come and shoot it in Penny and Gap.
When we come back, Robert Guype talks about community art as a pathway to sanity in these strange times.
It becomes an entity just that you can turn to, anybody in the community can turn to when you just want to be around reasonable people.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Hey there. If you're enjoying Southbound and our other programming here on WFAE, you also might enjoy our arts and culture newsletter called Tapestry. Every week, Tapestry takes a deeper dive into music, dance, visual art, anything you can think of, and the growing and thriving Charlotte arts community. Recent newsletters have had a story on VizArt, the beloved video store still hanging in there, and also a new recording studio that its owner calls a YMCA for music. If you're interested, sign up at wfae.org/tapestry. It's easy, and it'll make you a savvy fan of the arts in Charlotte. Now, back to Southbound and my conversation with Robert Guy. So as I'm sure you know, when people think about Appalachia, I guess, and certainly in the last 8 or 10 years, the thing they think about the most is Hillbilly Elegy, that J.D. Vance book. And I know a lot of people, writers, creative people who live in Appalachia, spend a lot of time there, have pushed back on that book pretty hard. And I just wonder what you think that book got wrong.
Yeah, I've never heard of it. I don't know what you're talking about.
So theoretically, Rob,
if there were such a book written by such a,
if there were such
written
a book.
By such a man, but seriously, we do get asked a lot, and you know, I think that person's had enough attention for that product. I'm like, you know, I'll say this. I think that book had more to do with what liberals outside of the region wanted Appalachia to be than anything else.
So explain that.
Well, the politics of the last, well, the politics in the United States are, and this kind of goes back to what I was saying about that other comment. You know, I think that Democrats, which I am, really don't understand what the big beef with socialism is. I mean, some of those countries in Northern Europe look pretty pleasant if it wasn't for the weather. But anyway, so just to say that, I think liberals in this country are quick to pin blame on everybody, but the left system, particularly as it's working out in kind of the upper middle class, to demonize the region where I live as the reason that Trump got elected is to do a major disservice to all the people who enabled him all over the country. I think that you saw that again with the Capitol rallies. Not that there weren't plenty of Appalachians involved in that. I find out every day somebody else that I was aware of that was there. And but that, you know, this was a national political phenomenon, and it's the wages of a white supremacist system that's been propped up by both political parties for a long flipping time. And so I think that, you know, to blame Eastern Kentucky or West Virginia for what's going on here, people on the left, it's very convenient.
It does remind me what you said about, you know, I know you're talking about your particular slice of the world, but I think it does speak to a larger way in that people tend to write off the South as a whole, or at least did before the stuff that happened in Georgia. And your book, I know, kind of traces in a fictional way some of the real work that happened and has happened for decades for people working for social justice, better life, clean water, all those sorts of things in Appalachia and all those places in the South. And I do think that work tends to get, I don't know, wallpapered over a little bit at election time when people just sort of write off the region. I mean, is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, in the places where people have been encouraged and enabled, I mean, I think that's the thing, you know, that people that talk about with all the problems in the South, the problems are with the power structure in the South and the white power structure in the South. And in places where Black people and others have been enabled and empowered and have taken the power that they rightfully thought was theirs within a democratic society, things look a lot different in the South. To rebuild the left in the South, you know, you've got to enable a lot of the people who haven't been participating. I mean, instead of just like trying to steal votes from the other party, which I think isn't proven to be a very effective strategy, you have to activate all these people who aren't participating, either because they're being shut out or because they're so annoyed. And I know that's, as a community college teacher, I know that's certainly true for a lot of the young people here. I mean, we're working on our ninth higher ground play right now, and a lot of it is turning on, we had a Black Lives Matter rally here back in May in a 97% white Appalachian Trump dominated county. And, and it was organized by young people, Black and white. And, these, and a lot of whom had not been politically active. I've come to believe that there's a lot of people on both sides of the aisle in government who are pretty scared of what would happen if people actually did care enough to get involved in the government.
The work y'all done on higher ground is, you know, not only touched a lot of the nerves and, you know, that are going through the community, it's set out to touch them. You know, you want to talk about these things, and And I just wonder, kind of, if there has been any sort of blowback, or do you feel there's some stuff in your book about where, you know, you have a sort of a rogue DJ who's sort of calling out some of the company, and the people are telling him to shut up. Do you hear voices telling you guys to shut up?
Higher Ground, it's, I mean, you know, and we're probably 30 or 40 people making theater, none of whom are professional theater people. Well, we have a couple, but where their primary motivation is really to use art, to, in this case, theater, music, and storytelling, to create a space in the community to just kind of talk about things. And we're pretty, I mean, the thing is, it's a political act to talk about things. You know, people will say you're being political, even if you don't take a side on an issue, if you're putting out a play that brings up the issue. And usually the people who say that endorse a particular political view. You know, it's like, if nobody talks about anything, that tends to work out for some people and not for others. And so, you know, we're pretty diligent about not advocating for any point of view except the idea that it should be okay for citizens in a democratic society to talk about the issues that affect their health and welfare. So I think that, you know, within Higher Ground, we've been pretty attentive to the fact that if you get too far out there, people aren't going to come to the show, even if their kids are in it. And so, you know, you want, if your goal is engagement and conversation, you can't get out there too far without balancing off by love, taking care to respect the other people's side.
I always hesitate to ask this of any artist, because sometimes it's so hard to tell the impact of work that goes out. But, you know, you've been doing this a long time up there. Have you felt like, or seen places where the work that y'all have done through theater or whatever else has impacted lives or changed people's minds or got people talking in different ways?
I think that for the participants, which is not a few, you know, it's in a county of 25,000 to have 95 people in a play is pretty impactful just in itself. And then for 40 or 50 of them to kind of continue to see that organization as something worth putting a lot of unpaid time into, that's filling a goal or filling a niche in people's lives, just who believe in the idea that you need a place to talk about things. It becomes an entity just that you can turn to, anybody in the community can turn to when you just want to be around reasonable people. You know, that not to say that, you know, because there's a fair amount of diversity within our group politically. And so just to hang on to a place where people are getting together to laugh and eat and tell stories together, some of which, you know, we try and represent everybody's point of view in, is impactful, I think.
So I want to spin it back to when you started doing all this. I know you've been up there now for most of the last 30 plus years. When you started kind of launching some of these projects, did you have in mind that this was going to be like a real long-term thing? Or do you think, I'm going to spend a few years here and do this and see where that goes, maybe try something else? I mean, what was in your head when you started?
There's that great Vic Chestnut line in one of his songs that I'm looking forward to the future, but I've never been much of a planner. That's pretty much me. I think that, you don't have a life's work until you do. I think at this point, you know, I think about where it goes and how to position things to move forward. But I have, to my probably discredit, I was always a person that didn't pay much attention to what came before, but just was like trying to figure out what my contribution was, what I wanted. You know, I was never really a person that like, look to fit myself into a pre-existing thing. And so I always felt like that it was only fair not to expect anybody else to carry on what I had started, you know, and so to that end, you know, you just get up and do the thing that makes sense. And, you know, you've got values that persist, like involving people, making people, reminding people that what's inside them is valuable and, you know, deserves to be in the world and that kind of stuff. And the things we do together are better than things we do by ourselves, that, you know, I could extract out a lot of values that have kind of organized the work over the years. But in terms of, you know, setting up in an institution or something like that, I don't know. That seemed a little hubristic.
As you've well documented in your work, many people who grow up in the place where you live can't wait to get out. You have been the opposite. You came in from the outside and you've stayed. Why have you stayed?
Well, I've been able to stay. That's a huge part of it. And, you know, like the people that do stay, you know, I've got a real community, if not a family, at least a community. It's been fun. We've had a lot of artists from outside, professional artists come in and new people come in. And it's been very interesting, like this play we're producing right now. You know, we're doing a lot of it virtually so people can participate without actually even being here. But we're having these discussions and it's really cool to like make something new and creative that part of the team are professional artists and part of it are just working people. It's very I mean this with no disrespect, but you know, I've worked on two projects that were one that went to Sundance Film Festival and another that's going to be on Hulu, and people don't believe me, but it's like, man, doing the books, I don't think there's anything I do that's more important than this community art stuff. You know, we try and bring in a different director every time just to keep it interesting for people. And, you know, and they just always get knocked out at what a high level these just working people are thinking about their art, you know, like thinking about what stories to tell and thinking about how to, you know, deal with a hard issue in a way that the community can handle it. They can believe it or not, but it's as good as anything going.
Years ago, I visited Robert Guype at his house in Harlan, Kentucky. To get from the street to his front door, you've got to go up 69 concrete steps. You really have to want to live in a place like that. And Rob Guype wants to live in that place that so many other people look down on. He sees the pain in Appalachia and the anger, but he also sees the humor and the beauty and the art of just trying to survive every day. At street level, where Guype's work lives, Appalachia can be a despairing place. But from up high, like at the top of those 69 steps, even a little cold town like Harlan is beautiful. Robert Guype's gift is that he can see both the high and the low, and he can help other people see it too. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audio engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.